House Committee on Environment and Energy, Hearing Room E, March 30th, 1987. Public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3168. Public hearing, House Bill 2144, House Bill 2145. Public hearing and possible work session, House Bill 3321. Work session, House Bill 2026.
This session of the House Environment and Energy Committee to order. The clerk will note that Representative Berea will be late. The other members of the committee are here. Several items before we get into our first hearing. We need to think about having either extended meeting or a night meeting, perhaps next week. We've got so much on the docket. We were thinking about April 8th, which would be Wednesday. Let me ask the committee, if we were to do a late session, would you prefer to have us just to go beyond 6 or to come back after dinner? Any preference? Yes, Representative Parkinson.
I'd assume it would be starting at 1 o'clock.
1:30, but we could start at 1.
How about a break maybe between 5 and 6?
Do that and come back at 6?
Yeah.
All right, that'd be fine. Okay, yes, the 8th, which would be Wednesday, is that?
How about the
don't have much
can we just shove up the time of starting?
We can start at 1. Let's try to do that. We'll cut as many corners as we can on it.
I prefer that.
All right, we have a number of major bills. We do have two major bills that affect timber and land use, which will be on our docket for a hearing on Friday of a week from Friday, that is on the 10th. The governor's office has prepared a land use bill in reference to the gorge question. As you recall earlier, they had talked about a third bill. We will get that put in LC form, and the committee will probably have to introduce that, but that will take some time. So we've got some major issues we need to get into. So let's do the 8th, and we will work out the pieces so we can cut it as much as we can. One item, again, before we get into our hearing, that's in reference to our Deschutes bill that we passed out on Wednesday of last week. And there is, I talked, I think, to several of you, some concern about one of the amendments. And we have not yet dropped the bill. What we can do with it, we could at this point, if you'd like, suspend our rules and take a reconsideration. If 6 of the members want reconsideration, we could then put it on a work session on Wednesday and take another look at it. And I would recommend, I think that's what we do, and if at that point you still want to keep it that way, you could, but it seems to me that it's the sort of an issue that I would prefer, if possible, to avoid a major hassle on the floor. I don't see why that bill couldn't be an unanimous bill on the floor.
You want a motion to reconsider?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair.
We have to amend the rule first.
It has to come from the prevailing side.
It has to come from the prevailing side, and there was only one that voted against it, so all the rest of you. But we have to amend the rules, suspend the rules first.
I'd move to suspend the rules to allow us to bring back bill, House Bill. What was the number?
2919.
Is there any objection to suspending the rules? If not, then we'll accept the motion for reconsideration.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we reconsider the vote by which we passed out House Bill 2119.
Right.
2919.
Any discussion? Let me say we'll ask the clerk to call the roll. If we get 6 votes, we'll simply put it on work session for Wednesday and complete it. Take a look at what we've done and see if we can resolve it. If the clerk would call the roll, this is simply for reconsideration at this point.
Aye.
Representative Berea.
Aye.
Representative Ekus.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Parkinson.
Aye.
Representative Peterson.
Aye.
Representative Thaw.
Aye.
Mr. Chair.
Aye. We will be the first item then on a work session on Wednesday. I'd like also at this point to refer House Bill 3072, which is the bill that would provide a separate code for telecommunications to our telecommunications subcommittee. Our first hearing then today is on House Bill 3168. And I will open the hearing on that bill and ask Representative Peterson, who is the chief sponsor, if she'd like to give the opening testimony.
She left.
She left? Yeah, there she is. She's in the habit of doing that, running in and out.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm State Representative Nancy Peterson from District 52. The bill that I have introduced today comes out of an experience that began in November 1985. The time I was in Salem for one of my committee meetings, this was after session, and I got a phone call from someone in the Pinehurst area in Southern Oregon, which is a rural community sort of south and a little bit east of Ashland, very close to the California border. This person was very excited because they'd heard that a fairly large transmission line was going in between California and Oregon, and they wanted to know what I knew about it. Well, I knew absolutely nothing about it, and over the next few weeks, not only did I find out about it, but all the elected officials in Southern Oregon did, as well as the governor of Oregon. Because as it turned out, this was a fairly major transmission line, but because of the way Oregon's law is currently written, it didn't fall under the jurisdiction of the Energy Siting Council, Energy Facility Siting Council. One of the portions of the law indicating what it is the Siting Council shall be responsible for says any line of 230 kilovolts in excess of that going through at least two jurisdictions and over 10 miles in length. This particular line met all the criteria except for over 10 miles in length. It was right around 9 miles, yet a fairly serious energy transmission line in Southern Oregon. The people in the area of Pinehurst activated very quickly, and I have two people with me today, Paul Caffrey and Doug Frank, and they will be speaking more specifically to the experiences they went through. But I did become very involved because it seemed not to make sense to me that a transmission line of this magnitude should not have any sort of review, and because of the way Oregon law was written, it would not. The governor did get active. He formed a special committee, which Paul Caffrey sat on, to review this committee. This particular line will not be going through my section of Southern Oregon. But that doesn't really matter. It is going through Southern Oregon, farther to the east. It is still under 10 miles in jurisdiction and still will have a major impact on the community. Enough of an impact that we needed to put together some legislation. What I'd like to do is draw your attention to the hand engrossed bill, because I think that deals with all of our amendments. Now, I might point out my first reaction to solving this problem was just to eliminate that 10-mile length in the bill, to say, well, any public transmission line, whatever, that went through two jurisdictions was over the 230 kilovolts in length should be under the purview of the Energy Siting Council. We found there were various problems to that 10 mile, to deleting the 10-mile limitation, so we tried yet another way. The second way we talked about is in your bill, and I believe it speaks to the original bill on page 3, dealing with the high voltage transmission line designed to increase the net capacity to export power. In other words, the length of the line wouldn't matter, but the size of the line and its ability to export power. We found out in talking with the Department of Energy this was perhaps not the best way to go, and that the real solution was giving local people an opportunity at whatever chance they had or we could establish by law to comment on this kind of thing. So what you have before you is the bill that would do this. The amended Section 2 we're talking about, Part A, provides for notification of the citizens. Now, prior to this legislation, which I'm introducing today, there was notification provided, but nothing had to be done other than the notification. This notification would go to all citizens within the corridor, within, I believe it's 10 miles of the corridor. These gentlemen can speak more specifically to that. It would allow for newspaper advertisements notifying that this was going to happen. It would allow 24 months between the time public notice was given and the actual construction of a line of this magnitude. And again, we're talking about in excess of 230 kilovolts. It would require, in Section 2, the public comment opportunity for the public to comment on such a transmission line, and that the power company interested must provide this. Section 3 then goes on to say that the Oregon Director of Energy shall establish a committee and coordinate a public review of such a project, if requested to do so, either by an ordinance or resolution of the local governing body, or by at least 50 people within the affected corridor. So again, we're having an opportunity to hear locals on this kind of major issue. Section 3 talks about, after listening to the utility's reasons for this request, for the proposed construction, the citizens then will ask the Department of Energy to help them establish a committee if there is a concern, and the committee's recommendations will go on to the governor. This work will be done primarily by the locals with help from the Department of Energy. What this bill does is demonstrate that public input, if it's given both the time and support it deserves, is necessary to creating good public policy. And what I'd like to do to conclude my statements is to quote from one of the Jackson County commissioners, a letter coming from the three county commissioners, which was recently passed out to you. You might be interested to know that in Southern Oregon, the county commissioners were very concerned about this because they seem to have absolutely no jurisdiction over the project. And if I may quote from this letter, "So much of our energy and government is eaten up in the struggle against misinformation, cynicism, and suspicion. Complete consensus, of course, is rarely possible in these kinds of issues. But the process mandated by House Bill 3168 could measurably increase the level of public acceptance of controversial decisions. Individuals may not be happy with the result, but the knowledge that they've been heard will likely make them less unhappy. That's an improvement that could make our public policy making a much easier process." So with that, I'd like to turn it over to two people from the Pinehurst area that have been very active in this whole issue, Paul Caffrey and Doug Frank.
Let me ask you, Nancy, the one page sheet we got is from Paul Caffrey,
yes.
C-A-F-F-R-E-Y?
Yes.
Thank you.
My name is Douglas Frank. I've lived for 12 years with my family in the Green Springs community about 20 miles east of Ashland, Oregon. I teach in a small college extension program, and I'm presently serving as a chairperson for our community watchdog group, the Friends of the Green Springs. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of my neighbors in the Green Springs area in support of legislation we believe is in the interests of our small mountain community. The Green Springs neighborhood is an unincorporated community of perhaps 100 or so residences strung out along 8 or 10 miles of State Highway 66 or the Green Springs Highway in a mountainous corner of Jackson County, just north of the California border. On the map that you have in front of you, we are the northern terminus of the westernmost corridor on the proposed power line map. We're ranchers and loggers, retired couples, part-time farmers, craftspersons and day laborers, artists and writers, business and professional people. Economically, we're tied to the Rogue Valley, particularly Ashland, about 20 miles away. Socially, however, we're a genuine rural community with many common interests, and with regular personal interactions centering around our own public school, grades K through 8, a variety of religious and support groups, and a couple local cafe gathering spots. Not many of us have resided on the Green Springs for more than my 12 years. Most of us chose this neighborhood carefully, impressed with the quality of schooling available to our kids, in love with the scenic beauty and the rural isolation, and hoping to actualize the opportunities for genuine neighborliness that we sensed were present here. In November of 1985, two of my neighbors rushed into my house without pausing to knock and asked me if I had heard about the power line that was to be constructed through our community, and to their dismay, within a quarter mile of their homes. I had, in fact, just gotten wind of this plan the evening before from an acquaintance about 10 miles south of us in Northern California. He was part of a citizens group near Yreka that had been opposing the power line project for almost a year. Not a single resident of the Green Springs community had gotten word of this project, however. Not even the half dozen or so property owners on whose land the power line would be constructed. As you can imagine, the word spread quickly through our little community, and a good bit of misinformation and anger along with it. Over the next couple weeks, a few of us tried to get to the bottom of the matter and share what information we had with the rest of the community in a public meeting in December of 85. What we found out was that a power line is indeed planned for Southern Oregon, and that one of its proposed routes passes through our community. This power line is known as the California-Oregon Transmission Project. It's a 500 kilovolt AC transmission line to be built under the auspices of the Transmission Agency of Northern California, representing a wide consortium of municipal and other utilities in California. The project is federally mandated and under the jurisdiction of the Western Area Power Administration, although both PP&L and the BPA are interested parties. The purpose of the power line is to make available to utilities in Central and Southern California the supposed excess energy produced in the Pacific Northwest, despite reliable indications that this surplus will disappear in less than a decade. Hundreds of miles of this power line, of course, will be in California, running most of the length of the Central Valley. It will cross the Oregon border at one of three alternative points, south of either Malin, Keno, or the Green Springs area, and run only 9 miles in Oregon before connecting with transmission lines owned by PP&L. The PP&L line with which it is intended to connect was built about 10 years ago, running east and west through our neighborhood, parallel to the Green Springs Highway. At that time, the Green Springs residents exerted serious and sustained opposition to that line. We cited studies demonstrating that the line was not needed and suggested that PP&L had designed the line for purposes not yet made public. The currently proposed line leads us to believe we may have been right 10 years ago, and that perhaps our neighborhood is destined to be a major corridor for the shipment of electric power from the Northwest and Canada to distant population centers in California and the Southwest. All this has, of course, been very disturbing to the residents of the Green Springs. The proposed power line route cuts a swath along the Jenny Creek watershed, a Class I fishing stream and one of the foremost scenic features of our community. The proposed line bisects our community north and south, as the 10-year-old power line bisects it east and west. And its route takes it across a number of rural residences and cattle ranches whose amenities and productivity have been won by economic sacrifice and years of hard work. The Green Springs residents, with barely a single dissenting voice, have come to understand this power line to be a threat to the interests of their community. At the meeting held in December 85, they gave their overwhelming support to the formation of an official group to represent the interests of the community in connection with the power line proposal. This group became known as the Friends of the Green Springs, or FOG for short. The board of directors of FOG set as its primary task the gathering of every possible bit of information available on the proposed California-Oregon transmission project. At the same time, it tried to determine exactly which governing bodies might have jurisdiction over the proposed line, and why those governing bodies had not taken the time to inform the community of the project. You can imagine our dismay when we discovered that both Jackson County and the state of Oregon were essentially uninvolved and powerless in the matter. In the first shock of the discovery, it looked as if we were at the mercy of a group of California utilities that could do whatever they wanted with our little strip of Southern Oregon. The reason for the state's lack of involvement was simple. ORS 469, a law aimed at energy conservation and efficiency, established the Department of Energy and the Energy Facilities Siting Council, which gives state jurisdiction to the construction of a high-voltage transmission line in excess of 230 kilovolts. This jurisdiction excludes, however, any such lines that are 10 miles or less in length. and it excludes any such lines that are constructed entirely within one political subdivision in the state. Under both exclusions, the 9-mile line proposed for our remote corner of Jackson County would receive no attention from the state of Oregon. That left us with only the county government to speak for us. But the county government did not have the resources to research the matter carefully, nor the status from which to exert any meaningful influence over giant California agencies or even more powerful federal agencies like the Western Area Power Administration. The representative of this agency made it quite clear in a public hearing that the federal government would not seek approval for its power line from any county government in connection with county land use laws. What we learned very quickly, in other words, was that we had formal legal protection neither from the county nor from the state government. Until Governor Attia's intervention and the establishment of the Oregon Review Committee, we appeared to be in the less than disinterested hands of the transmission agency in Northern California. Let me give you the flavor of our involvement with that agency. In its April 85 newsletter, the agency introduced the power line proposal to the public and announced an active program to involve the public in project decisions. Public scoping meetings were to be held in 15 communities in May 85. Only one of these meetings was to be held in Oregon. That one was scheduled for Ashland, outside the boundaries of the proposed study area and over 20 miles from the Green Springs community. Although the agency reports that it announced this meeting publicly, our review of the Ashland Daily Tidings for May of 85 failed to turn up any notice of it. No Green Springs residents knew of the public meeting, and none attended. Power line planning went ahead without them. In the Power Line Project's next newsletter, the proposed power line routes were announced and public comment was encouraged. One of the routes, as I've said, entered Oregon near Agate Flat and ran north along the Jenny Creek, tying into existing power facilities in the heart of the Green Springs neighborhood. No one on the Green Springs yet knew about this, however. No one was receiving the agency's newsletter. No one from our neighborhood thus attended the single public workshop scheduled for Oregon, held in Klamath Falls on July 15th, this time about 40 miles from our community. There's no evidence that the power line agency's personnel took note of this absence or worked to correct it. In its fourth newsletter, the agency announced a series of public workshops scheduled for late November 1985 in six communities. All six were in California. The citizens of Southern Oregon were given no public forum for the expression of their concerns. Late in November, then, as I've said, our community first learned by word of mouth of the proposed power line. When we communicated our dismay to the Transmission Agency of Northern California, the agency replied that it had worked hard to inform the public, and that essentially our lack of information was our own fault. Green Springs citizens were encouraged to present their concerns in writing within the next few days, if they wished to meet the deadline for the draft environmental impact statement to be released in May 1986. Since we had just then learned of the project and were in possession of only the skimpiest information, we could not meet the deadline. Finally, in January 1986, we held our own public meeting in the Green Springs community with representatives of the Transmission Agency of Northern California explaining to us for the first time what was being planned for our neighborhood. The agency assured us that our concerns would be addressed. We presented our environmental concerns in great detail, later sending them in the form of written testimony to the agency. When in April 1986, the agency published its draft Phase 1 report, an account of public issues and concerns that had been raised in the public meetings, the concerns we had voiced had not been addressed in any serious or comprehensive manner. The draft report showed substantial use of biological and other resource information from California agencies, but ignored identical resources for the state of Oregon. In sum, the draft report showed little interest in the concerns of Oregon citizens, and in particular those of the Green Springs residents. The experience of our Green Springs community with the California-Oregon Transmission Project is a case study in the frustration that results when groups of citizens attempt to protect their rights from encroachment by well-financed, well-staffed public and private agencies. It's our sincere hope that the legislation before you will offer some meaningful protection when experiences such as ours are repeated in the future. The bill would apply specifically to those communities like our own whose interests are excluded from the oversight of the Energy Facility Siting Council. It would require written notification of property owners directly affected by such a power line. It would require more effective public notice of and public involvement in a proposed power line project. It would ensure that the interests of the citizens would receive a hearing at the state level and possibly enlist state influence over those powerful private and federal agencies who, without such influence, are prone to run roughshod over local and regional concerns. I assure you that unincorporated rural communities like ours are intensely interested in the quality of their natural and social environments and want very much to be consulted in matters which will inevitably affect their lives and the lives of their children. Increasingly, such communities as ours are willing to commit time and energy to public processes which will enhance the survival of a way of life that they have chosen for themselves and their families. Since January of 1986, significant numbers of Green Springs residents have met on a weekly or biweekly basis under the auspices of the Friends of the Green Springs to stop the intrusion of this power line into our community. We have held public meetings in order to question and communicate with representatives of the Transmission Agency of Northern California, PPNL, the Bonneville Power Administration, Western Area Power Administration, county and state representatives. We've conducted thorough ongoing research into the effects of high voltage power lines on human health, grazing and livestock, rare or endangered plants, wildlife and fisheries, timber production, soil erosion, water quality, property values, and general quality of life. We have spent hours trying to determine how or whether the power line project would be of economic or environmental benefit to the state of Oregon as a whole. We have sent participants to power line related meetings in California. We published briefing sheets for the public and have attracted the attention of the press. We've conducted tours of the affected area for state and county officials and legislators. And we've examined interminably long environmental impact statements and written somewhat shorter detailed responses. We've written dozens of letters to private as well as county, state, and federal agencies. Partly, at least, due to the furor we raised, Governor Attia instituted a citizens' review process under the sponsorship of the Oregon Department of Energy, and we've been actively involved with that process since its inception. My neighbor and colleague Paul Caffrey will have a bit more to say about that process in a minute. I'm saying all this, though, to underline my point that if the state of Oregon will guarantee public processes for citizen involvement, the citizenry will rise to the occasion and truly representative government will be enhanced. I urge you to support the bill, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Caffrey?
Hello, my name is Paul Caffrey. My comment testimony is going to be very brief because I would hope that if there's any time remaining, we could spend in answering any questions you may have. I'm a 5-year resident of the Green Springs Pinehurst area and an 11-year resident of the state of Oregon. I'm a member and past chairman of the Friends of Green Springs. I hold a professional degree in urban and regional planning and a master's degree in experiential education and work privately as a counselor. I'm also a citizen representative of the Pinehurst area to the Oregon Review Committee. The Oregon Review Committee was initiated in 1986 by Governor Attia, who directed the Oregon Department of Energy to put together a committee representative of the communities involved, state and other agencies, who might be impacted by the proposed power line project. We are still in existence and are charged with the task of monitoring the worth and impact of the proposed power line. Using criteria we developed, plus the guided and skilled assistance of the Oregon Department of Energy staff, we are, I feel, successfully approaching the closing results of this past year's work. Having just finished our response report to the draft EIS, I expect we will finalize our review with a comprehensive report to the governor sometime this early summer on the cost and cost benefit and summary conclusions of impact to the state of Oregon. What amounts to very favorable impressions of this committee under the skilled administration of the Oregon Department of Energy led me to believe in a need to formalize and legitimize this process in the bill now before you. The process is a good one in that it is participatory in nature, democratic and responsible. It allows for a means and a place to dialogue, debate, and express differences. Most importantly, it provides a vital link between vulnerable and often unincorporated communities, such as ours, and the state. And in the face of a larger power, such as BPA and the Transmission Agency of Northern California, the state becomes critical to a balance of power. More likely than not, the transmission line will be built despite our objections and possibly anyone else's. And most likely it will be built further east through Malin and not in the Pinehurst Green Springs area. However, we know we are still open to development for additional power lines and ripe for the picking because the existing 500 kV line, which was built in 1978, makes for an easy connection to California transmission. Further, many other communities will also be impacted with the future plans for shipment of power out of British Columbia. This bill, I feel, is needed to give all of us in this state at least some minimal margin of protection from such intrusions. That's all. Thank you.
If I may, Representative Cease, just one last comment to tie it up before this is open to questions or whoever's testifying next. That I see the strength of this bill is not requiring the Energy Siting Council to review everything in excess of 230 kilovolts, but to allow a process whereby if a community or if a political jurisdiction felt there was the need, then it could happen. It wouldn't automatically require it in every instance.
Thank you.
I think we're open to